the old woman said, as she looped her string around Sansa's chest.
You should not hide it so.
The comment made her blush. Yet the last time she'd gone riding, she could not lace her jerkin all the way to the top, and the stable boy gaped at her as he helped her mount. Sometimes she caught grown men looking at her chest as well, and some of her tunics were so tight she could scarce breathe in them. "What colour will it be?" she asked the seamstress.
"Leave the colours to me, my lady. You will be pleased, I know you will. You shall have small clothes and hose as well, kirtles and mantles and cloaks, and all else befitting a lovely young lady of noble birth."
"Will they be ready in time for the king's wedding?"
"Oh, sooner, much sooner. Her grace insists. I have 6 seamstresses and 12 apprentice girls, and we have set all other work aside for this. Many ladies will be cross with us, but it was the queen's command."
"Thank her grace kindly for her thoughtfulness," Sansa said politely. "She is too good to me."
"Her grace is most generous,"
the seamstress agreed, as she gathered up her things and took her leave. But why, Sansa wondered when she was alone. It made her uneasy. I'll wager this gown is Margaery's doing somehow, or her grandmother's. Margaery's kindness had been unfailing, and her presence changed everything. Her ladies welcomed Sansa as well. It had been so long since she had enjoyed the company of other women, she had almost forgotten how pleasant it could be. Lady Leonette gave her lessons on the high harp, and Lady Janna shared all the choice gossip. Mary Crane always had an amusing story, and little Lady Bulwer reminded her of Arya, though not so fierce. Closest to Sansa's own age were the cousins Eleanor, Arla, and Megha, Tyrells from junior branches of the house. "Roses from lower on the bush," quipped Eleanor, who was witty and willowy. Megha was round and loud, Arla shy and pretty. But Eleanor ruled the three by right of womanhood. She was a maiden flowered, whereas Megha and Arla were mere girls. The cousins took Sansa into their company as if they had known her all their lives. They spent long afternoons doing needlework and talking over lemon cakes and honeyed wine, played at tiles of an evening, sang together in the castle sept, and often one or two of them would be chosen to share Margaery's bed, where they would whisper half the night away. Arla had a lovely voice, and when coaxed would play the wood harp and sing songs of chivalry and lost loves. Megha couldn't sing, but she was mad to be kissed. She and Arla played a kissing game sometimes, she confessed, but it wasn't the same as kissing man, much less a king. Sansa wondered what Megha would think about kissing the hound, as she had. He'd come to her the night of the battle, stinking of wine and blood. "He kissed me, and threatened to kill me, and made me sing him a song."
"King Joffrey has such beautiful lips," Megha gushed, oblivious. "Oh, poor Sansa, how your heart must have broken when you lost him. Oh, how you must have wept."
"Joffrey made me weep more often than you know," she wanted to say. But Butterbumps was not at hand to drown out her voice, so she pressed her lips together and held her tongue. As for Eleanor, she was promised to a young squire, a son of Lord Ambrose. They would be wed as soon as he won his spurs. He had won her favour in the Battle of the Blackwater, where he'd slain a Moorish crossbowman and a Mullendor man-at-arms.
"Alan said her favour made him fearless," said Megha. "He says he shouted her name for his battle cry. Isn't that ever so gallant? Some day I want some champion to wear my favour and kill 100 men."
Eleanor told her to hush, but looked pleased all the same. "They are children," Sansa thought. "They are silly little girls, even Eleanor. They've never seen a battle. They've never seen a man die. They know nothing. Their dreams were full of songs and stories, the way hers had been before Joffrey cut her father's head off. Sansa pitied them. Sansa envied them. Margaery was different, though. Sweet and gentle, yet there was a little of her grandmother in her, too. The day before last, she'd taken Sansa hawking. It was the first time she'd been outside the city since the battle. The dead had been burned or buried, but the Mudgate was scarred and splintered, where Lord Stannis's rams had battered it, and the hulls of smashed ships could be seen along both sides of the Blackwater, charred masts poking from the shallows like gaunt black fingers. The only traffic was the flat-bottom ferry that took them across the river, and when they reached the Kingswood, they found a wilderness of ash and charcoal and dead trees. But the waterfowl teemed in the marshes along the bay, and Sansa's Merlin brought down three ducks while Margaery's peregrine took a heron in full flight. "Willis has the best birds in the Seven Kingdoms," Margaery said when the two of them were briefly alone. "He flies an eagle sometimes. You will see, Sansa." She took her by the hand and gave it a squeeze. "Sister?" "Sister?" Sansa had once dreamt of having a sister like Margaery, beautiful and gentle, with all the world's graces at her command. Arya had been entirely unsatisfactory as sisters went. "How can I let my sister marry Joffrey?" she thought, and suddenly her eyes were full of tears. "Margaery, please," she said, "you mustn't." It was hard to get the words out. "You mustn't marry him. He's not like he seems. He's not. He'll hurt you." "I shouldn't think so," Margaery smiled confidently. "It's brave of you to warn me, but you need not fear. Joffrey's spoiled and vain, and I don't doubt that he's cruel, as you say, but father forced him to name Loras to his king's guard before he would agree to the match. I shall have the finest knight in the Seven Kingdoms protecting me night and day, as Prince Aemon protected Nerys. So our little lion had best behave, hadn't he?" She laughed and said, "Come, sweet sister, let's race back to the river. It will drive our guards quite mad." And without waiting for an answer, she put her heels into a horse and flew. "She is so brave," Sansa thought, galloping after her, and yet her doubts still gnawed at her. Sir Loras was a great knight, all agreed, but Joffrey had other king's guard, and gold cloaks, and red cloaks besides, and when he was older he would command armies of his own. Aegon the Unworthy had never harmed Queen Nerys, perhaps for fear of their brother, the Dragon Knight. But when another of his king's guards fell in love with one of his mistresses, the king had taken both their heads. "Sir Loras is a Tyrell," Sansa reminded herself. "That other knight was only a Toyn. His brothers had no armies, no way to avenge him but with swords." Yet the more she thought about it all, the more she wondered. Joff might restrain himself for a few turns, perhaps as long as a year, but soon or late he will show his claws, and when he does, the realm might have a second Kingslayer, and there would be war inside the city, as the men of the Lion and the men of the Rose made the gutters run red. Sansa was surprised that Margaery did not see it too. "She is older than me. She must be wiser. And her father, Lord Tyrell, he knows what he is doing, surely. I am just being silly." When she told Sir Dontus that she was going to Highgarden to marry Willis Tyrell, she thought he would be relieved and pleased for her. Instead, he had grabbed her arm and said, "You cannot," in a voice as thick with horror as with wine. "I tell you, these Tyrells are only Lannisters with flowers. I beg of you, forget this folly. Give your Florian a kiss, and promise you'll go ahead as we have planned. The night of Joffrey's wedding, that's not so long, wear the silver hairnet and do as I told you. And afterwards we'll make our escape." He tried to plant a kiss on her cheek. Sansa slipped from his grasp and stepped away from him. "I won't. I can't. Something would go wrong. When I wanted to escape, you wouldn't take me. And now I don't need to." Donta stared at her stupidly. "But the arrangements are made, sweetling. The ship to take you home. The boat to take you to the ship. Your Florian did it all for his sweet Junquel.
I'm sorry for all the trouble I put you to, she said, but I have no need of boats and ships now.
But it's all to see you safe.
I will be safe in Highgarden. Willis will keep me safe.
But he does not know you,
Dantès insisted,
and he will not love you. Junquel, Junquel, open your sweet eyes. These Tyrells care nothing for you. It's your claim they mean to wed.
My claim? She was lost for a moment.
Sweetling, he told her, you are heir to Winterfell.
He grabbed her again, pleading that she must not do this thing, and Sansa wrenched free and left him swaying beneath the heart tree. She had not visited the Godswood since. But she had not forgotten his words either. The heir to Winterfell, she would think, as she lay abed at night. It's your claim they mean to wed. Sansa had grown up with three brothers. She never thought to have a claim. But with Bran and Rickon dead, it doesn't matter. There's still Rob. He's a man grown now, and soon he'll wed and have a son. Anyway, Willis Tyrell will have Highgarden. What would he want with Winterfell? Sometimes she would whisper his name into her pillow just to hear the sound of it. Willis, Willis, Willis. Willis was as good a name as Loras, she supposed. They even sounded the same. A little. What did it matter about his leg? Willis would be Lord of Highgarden, and she would be his lady. She pictured the two of them sitting together in a garden with puppies in their laps, or listening to a singer strum upon a lute while they floated down the Mander on a pleasure barge. If I give him sons, he may come to love me. She would name them Eddard and Brandon and Rickon, and raise them all to be as valiant as Sir Loras, and to hate Lannisters too. In Sansa's dreams, her children looked just like the brothers she had lost. Sometimes there was even a girl who looked like Arya. She could never hold the picture of Willis long in her head, though. Her imaginings kept turning him back into Sir Loras, young and graceful and beautiful. You must not think of him like that, she told herself, or else he may see the disappointment in your eyes when you meet. And how could he marry you then, knowing it was his brother you loved? Willis Tyrell was twice her age, she reminded herself constantly, and lame as well, and perhaps even plump and red-faced like his father. But calmly or no, he might be the only champion she would ever have. Once she dreamed it was still her marrying Joff, not Margaery, and on their wedding night he turned into the headsman, Ilion Payne. She woke trembling. She did not want Margaery to suffer as she had, but she had dreaded the thought that the Tyrells might refuse to go ahead with the wedding. I warned her, I did, I told her the truth of him. Perhaps Margaery did not believe her. Joff always played the perfect knight with her, as once he had with Sansa. She will see his true nature soon enough, after the wedding, if not before. Sansa decided that she would light a candle to the Mother Above the next time she visited the Sept, and ask her to protect Margaery from Joffrey's cruelty, and perhaps a candle to the warrior as well, for Loras. She would wear her new gown for the ceremony at the Great Sept of Baelor, she decided, as the seamstress took her last measurement. That must be why Cersei is having it made for me, so I will not look shabby at the wedding. She really ought to have a different gown for the feast afterward, but she supposed one of her old ones would do. She did not want to risk getting food or wine on the new one. I must take it with me to Highgarden. She wanted to look beautiful for Willis Tyrell, even if Dantès was right. And it is Winterfell he wants, and not me. He still may come to love me for myself. Sansa hugged herself tightly, wondering how long it would be before the gown was ready. She could scarcely wait to wear it. Arya. The rains came and went, but there was more grey sky than blue, and all the streams were running high. On the morning of the third day, Arya noticed that the moss was growing mostly on the wrong side of the trees.
"We're going the wrong way," she said to Gendry, as they rode past an especially mossy elm. "We're going south. See how the moss is growing on the trunk?"
He pushed thick black hair from his eyes and said, "We're following the road, that's all. The road goes south here."
"We've been going south all day," she wanted to tell him, "and yesterday too, when we were riding along that stream bed." But she hadn't been paying close attention yesterday, so she couldn't be certain.
"I think we're lost," she said in a low voice. "We shouldn't have left the river. All we had to do was follow it."
"The river bends and loops," said Gendry. "This is just a shorter way, I bet. Some secret outlaw way. Lem and Tom and them have been living here for years."
That was true. Arya bit her lip.
"But the moss. The way it's raining, we'll have moss growing from our ears before long," Gendry complained.
"Only from our south ear," Arya declared stubbornly. There was no use trying to convince the bull of anything. Still, he was the only true friend she had, now that Hot Pie had left them.
"Shauna says she needs me to bake bread," he told her the day they rode. "Anyhow, I'm tired of rain and saddle sores and being scared all the time. There's ale here and rabbit teat, and the bread will be better when I make it. You'll see when you come back. You will come back, won't you, when the war's done?"
He remembered who she was then and added,
"My lady,"
reddening. Arya didn't know if the war would ever be done, but she had nodded. "I'm sorry I beat you that time," she said. Hot Pie was stupid and craven, but he'd been with her all the way from King's Landing, and she'd gotten used to him. "I broke your nose."
"You broke Lem's too," Hot Pie grinned. "That was good."
"Lem didn't think so," Arya said glumly. Then it was time to go. When Hot Pie asked if he might kiss Milady's hand, she punched his shoulder.
"Don't call me that. You're Hot Pie, and I'm Harry."
"I'm not Hot Pie here. Shauna just calls me Boy, the same as she calls the other Boy. It's going to be confusing."
She missed him more than she thought she would, but Harwin made up for it some. She had told him about his father, Hullan, and how she'd found him dying by the stables in the Red Keep the day she fled. "He always said he'd die in a stable," Harwin said, "but we all thought some bad-tempered stallion would be his death, not a pack of lions." Arya told of Yoren and their escape from King's Landing as well, and much that had happened since. But she left out the stable boy she'd stabbed with needle, and the guard whose throat she'd cut to get out of Harrenhal. Telling Harwin would be almost like telling her father, and there were some things she could not bear having her father know. Nor did she speak of Jake and Hagar, and the three deaths he'd owed and paid. The iron coin he'd given her, Arya kept tucked away beneath her belt, but sometimes at night she would take it out, and remember how his face had melted and changed when he ran his hand across it. "Velar Morghulis," she would say under her breath. "Sir Gregor, Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler and the Hound, Sir Ilion, Sir Merin, Queen Cersei, King Joffrey." Only 6 Winterfell men remained of the 20 her father had sent west with Beric Dondarrion, Harwin told her, and they were scattered. "It was a trap, milady. Lord Tywin sent his mountain across the Red Fork with fire and sword, hoping to draw your lord father. He planned for Lord Eddard to come west himself, to deal with Gregor Clegane. If he had, he would have been killed or taken prisoner, and traded for the imp, who was your mother's captive at the time. Only the Kingslayer never knew Lord Tywin's plan, and when he heard about his brother's capture, he attacked your father in the streets of King's Landing." "I remember," said Arya. "He killed Jory." Jory had always smiled at her, when he wasn't telling her to get from underfoot.
"He killed Jory," Harwin agreed, "and your father's leg was broken when his horse fell on him. So Lord Eddard couldn't go west. He sent Lord Beric instead with 20 of his own men and 20 from Winterfell, me among them. There were others besides, Thoros and Sir Raymond Darry and their men, Sir Gladden Wild, a lord named Lothar Mallory, but Gregor was waiting for us at the Mummer's Ford with men concealed on both banks. As we crossed, he fell upon us from front and rear. I saw the mountain slay Raymond Darry with a single blow. So terrible, it took Darry's arm off at the elbow and killed the horse beneath him, too. Gladden Wild died there with him, and Lord Mallory was ridden down and drowned. We had lions on every side, and I thought I was doomed with the rest. But Alan shouted commands and restored order to our ranks, and those still a horse rallied around Thoros and cut our way free. 60 we'd been that morning. By dark, no more than 20 were left, and Lord Beric was gravely wounded. Thoros drew a foot of lance from his chest that night and poured boiling wine into the hole it left. Every man of us was certain his lordship would be dead by daybreak, but Thoros prayed with him all night beside the fire, and when dawn came he was still alive, and stronger than he had been. It was a fortnight before he could mount a horse, but his courage kept us strong. He told us that our war had not ended at the Mummer's Ford, but only begun there, and that every man of ours who'd fallen would be avenged tenfold. By then the fighting had passed by us. The mountain's men were only the van of Lord Tywin's host. They crossed the Red Fork in strength and swept up into the Riverlands, burning everything in their path. We were so few that all we could do was harry their rear. But we told each other that we'd join up with King Robert when he marched west to crush Lord Tywin's rebellion. Only then we heard that Robert was dead, and Lord Eddard as well, and Cersei Lannister's whelp had ascended the Iron Throne. That turned the whole world on his head. We'd been sent out by the King's Hand to deal with outlaws, you see, but now we were the outlaws, and Lord Tywin was the Hand of the King. There were some wanted to yield then, but Lord Beric wouldn't hear of it. We were still King's men, he said, and these were the King's people the lions were savaging. If we could not fight for Robert, we would fight for them, until every man of us was dead. And so we did. But as we fought, something queer happened. For every man we lost, 2 showed up to take his place. A few were knights or squires of gentle birth, but most were common men, field hands, and fiddlers, and innkeepers, servants, and shoemakers, even 2 septons, men of all sorts, and women too, children, dogs.
Dogs? Said Arya.
Aye, Harwin grinned. One of our lads keeps the meanest dogs you'd ever want to see.
I wish I had a good mean dog, said Arya wistfully. A lion-killing dog? She'd had a direwolf once, Nymeria, but she'd thrown rocks at her until she fled, to keep the queen from killing her. Could a direwolf kill a lion? She wondered. It rained again that afternoon, and long into the evening. Thankfully, the outlaws had secret friends all over, so they did not need to camp out in the open or seek shelter beneath some leaky bower, as she and Hutpie and Gendry had done so often. That night they sheltered in a burned, abandoned village. At least it seemed to be abandoned, until Jack Bilucky blew 2 short blasts and 2 long ones on his hunting horn. Then all sorts of people came crawling out of the ruins and up from secret cellars. They had ale and dried apples and some stale barley bread, and the outlaws had a goose that Angai had brought down on the ride, so supper that night was almost a feast. Arya was sucking the last bit of meat off a wing when one of the villagers turned to Lem Lemoncloak and said,
"There were men through here, not 2 days past, looking for the Kingslayer."
Lem snorted.
"They do better looking in Riverrun, down in the deepest dungeons, where it's nice and damp.
His nose looked like a squashed apple, red and raw and swollen, and his mood was foul.
"No," another villager said, "he's escaped."
The Kingslayer.
Arya could feel the hair on the back of her neck prickling. She held her breath to listen.
"Could that be true?"
Tom-O-Seven said.
"I'll not believe it," said the one-eyed man in the rusty pot-helm.
The other outlaws called him Jack Be Lucky, though losing an eye didn't seem very lucky to Arya.
"I've had me taste of them dungeons. How could he escape?"
The villagers could only shrug at that. Greenbeard stroked his thick grey and green whiskers and said,
"The wolves will drown in blood if the Kingslayer's loose again. Thoros must be told. The Lord of Late will show him Lannister in the flames."
"There's a fine fire burning here," said Angai, smiling. Greenbeard laughed and cuffed the archer's ear.
"Do I look like a priest to you, archer? When Pillow of Tyrosh peers into the fire, the cinders singe his beard."
Lem cracked his knuckles and said,
"Wouldn't Lord Beric love to capture Jaime Lannister, though?"
"Would he hang him then, Lem?"
one of the village women asked.
"It'll be half a shame to hang a man as pretty as that one."
"A trial first," said Angai. "Lord Beric always gives him a trial, you know that." He smiled. "Then he hangs him." There was laughter all around. Then Tom drew his fingers across the strings of his wood harp and broke into soft song.
"The brothers of the Kingswood, they were an outlaw band. The forest was their castle, but they roamed across the land. No man's gold was safe from them, nor any maiden's hand. Oh, the brothers of the Kingswood, that fearsome outlaw band."
Warm and dry in a corner, between Gendry and Harwin, Arya listened to the singing for a time, then closed her eyes and drifted off to sleep. She dreamt of home, not River Run, but Winterfell. It was not a good dream, though. She was alone, outside the castle, up to her knees in mud. She could see the grey walls ahead of her, but when she tried to reach the gates, every step seemed harder than the one before, and the castle faded before her, until it looked more like smoke than granite. And there were wolves as well, gaunt grey shapes stalking through the trees all around her, their eyes shining. Whenever she looked at them, she remembered the taste of blood. The next morning they left the road to cut across the fields. The wind was gusting, sending dry brown leaves swirling around the hooves of their horses, but for once it did not rain. When the sun came out from behind a cloud, it was so bright Arya had to pull her hood forward to keep it out of her eyes. She reined up very suddenly.
"We are going the wrong way."
Gendry groaned.
"What is it, moss again? Look at the sun," she said. "We're going south."
Arya rummaged in her saddlebag for the map, so she could show them.
"We should never have left the Triton, see?"
She unrolled the map on her leg. All of them were looking at her now. "See, there's River Run between the rivers."
"As it happens," said Jack Belocchi, "we know where River Run is, every man of us."
"You're not going to River Run,"
Lem told her bluntly.
"I was almost there," Arya thought. "I should have let them take our horses. I could have walked the rest of the way."
She remembered her dream then, and bit her lip.
"Don't look so hurt, child," said Tom Sevenstrings. "No harm will come to you. You have my word on that."
"The word of a liar?"
"No one lied," said Lem. "We made no promises. It's not for us to say what's to be done with you."
Lem was not the leader, though, no more than Tom. That was Greenbeard, the Tyroshi. Arya turned to face him. "Take me to River Run, and you'll be rewarded," she said desperately.
"Little one," Greenbeard answered. "A peasant may skin a common squirrel for his pot, but if he finds a gold squirrel in his tree, he takes it to his lord, or he will wish he did."
"I'm not a squirrel," Arya insisted.
"Yeah," Greenbeard laughed. "A little gold squirrel
who's off to see the Lightning Lord, whether she wills it or not. He'll know what's to be done with you. I'll wager he'll send you back to your lady mother just as you wish."
Tom Sevenstrings nodded. "Aye, that's like Lord Beric. He'll do right by you. See if he don't."
Lord Beric Dondarrion. Arya remembered all she had heard at Harrenhal from the Lannisters and the Bloody Mamas alike. Lord Beric, the Wisp of the Wood, Lord Beric, who'd been killed by Varga Hote, and before that by Sir Aemery Lorch, and twice by the Mountain That Rides. If he won't send me home, maybe I'll kill him too. "Why do I have to see Lord Beric?" she asked quietly.
"We bring him all our high-born captives," said Angai.
"Captive?" Arya took a breath to still her soul.
"Calm as still water."
She glanced at the outlaws on their horses, and turned her horse's head.
"Now, quick as a snake," she thought, as she slammed her heels into the courser's flank. Right between Greenbeard and Jack Be Lucky she flew, and caught one glimpse of Gendry's startled face as his mount moved out of her way. And then she was in the open field and running. North or south, east or west, that made no matter now. She could find the way to River Run later, once she'd lost them. Arya leaned forward in the saddle and urged the horse to a gallop. Behind her, the outlaws were cursing and shouting at her to come back. She shut her ears to the calls, but when she glanced back over her shoulder, four of them were coming after her. Angai and Harwin and Greenbeard racing side by side, with Lem farther back, his big yellow cloak flapping behind him as he rode.
"Swift as a deer," she told her mount.
"Run now, run!"
Arya dashed across brown, weedy fields, through waist-high grass and piles of dry leaves that flurried and flew when her horse galloped past. There were woods to her left, she saw. "I can lose them there." A dry ditch ran along one side of the field, but she leapt it without breaking stride, and plunged in among the stand of elm and yew and birch trees. A quick peek back showed Angai and Harwin still hard on her heels. Greenbeard had fallen behind, though, and she could not see Lem at all.
"Faster," she told her horse. "You can, you can."
Between two elms she rode, and never paused to see which side the moss was growing on. She leapt a rotten log and swung wide around a monstrous deadfall, jagged with broken branches. Then up a gentle slope and down the other side, slowing and speeding up again, her horse's shoes striking sparks off the flintstones underfoot. At the top of the hill she glanced back. Harwin had pushed ahead of Angai, but both were coming hard. Greenbeard had fallen further back and seemed to be flagging. A stream barred her way. She splashed down into it, through water choked with wet brown leaves. Some clung to a horse's legs as they climbed the other side. The undergrowth was thicker here, the ground so full of roots and rocks that she had to slow. But she kept as good a pace as she dared. Another hill before her, this one steeper. Up she went, and down again. How big are these woods, she wondered. She had the faster horse, she knew that. She had stolen one of Bruce Bolton's best from the stables at Harrenhal, but his speed was wasted here. I need to find the fields again. I need to find a road. Instead, she found a game trail. It was narrow and uneven, but it was something. She raced along it, branches whipping at her face. One snagged her hood and yanked it back, and for half a heartbeat she feared they had caught her. A vixen burst from the brush as she passed, startled by the fury of her flight. The game trail brought her to another stream. Or was it the same one? Had she gotten turned around? There was no time to puzzle it out. She could hear the horses crashing through the trees behind her. Thorns scratched at her face like the cats she used to chase in King's Landing. Sparrows exploded from the branches of an alder, but the trees were thinning now, and suddenly she was out of them. Broad, level fields stretched before her, all weeds and wild wheat, sudden and trampled. Arya kicked her horse back to a gallop.
"Run!" she thought. "Run for River Run! Run for home!"
Had she lost them? She took one quick look, and there was Harwin, 6 yards back and gaining.
"No," she thought. "No, he can't. Not him. It isn't fair."
Both horses were lathered and flagging by the time he came up beside her, reached over, and grabbed her bridle.
Arya was breathing hard herself then. She knew the fight was done. "You ride like a Northman, milady," Harwin said when he'd drawn them to a halt. "Your aunt was the same, Lady Lyanna. But my father was master of horse, remember?" The look she gave him was full of hurt. "I thought you were my father's man. Lord Eddard's dead, milady. I belong to the Lightning Lord now, and to my brothers." "What brothers?" Old Hullan had fathered no other sons that Arya could remember. "Anguy, Lem, Thomas Evans, Jack, and Greenbeard, all of them. We mean your brother Rob no ill, milady, but it's not him we fight for. He has an army all his own, and many a great lord to bend the knee. The small folk have only us." He gave her a searching look. "Can you understand what I'm telling you?" Yes, that he was not Rob's man, she understood well enough, and that she was his captive. "I could have stayed with Hot Pie. We could have taken the little boat and sailed it up to River Run." She had been better off as Squab. No one would take Squab captive, or Nan, or Weasel, or Arry, the orphan boy. "I was a wolf," she thought. "But now I'm just some stupid little lady again." "Will you ride back peaceful now?" Harwin asked her. "Or must I tie you up and throw you across your horse?" "All right, peaceful," she said sullenly. "For now." Samwell. Sobbing, Sam took another step.
"This is the last one. The very last. I can't go on. I can't."
But his feet moved again. One, and then the other. They took a step, then another, and he thought,
"They're not my feet. They're someone else's. Someone else is walking. It can't be me."
When he looked down, he could see them stumbling through the snow, shapeless things and clumsy. His boots had been black, he seemed to remember, but the snow had caked around them, and now they were misshapen white balls, like two club feet made of ice. It would not stop, the snow. The drifts were up past his knees, and a crust covered his lower legs like a pair of white greaves. His steps were dragging, lurching. The heavy pack he carried made him look like some monstrous hunchback.
And he was tired. So tired. "I can't go on. Mother, have mercy. I can't."
Every fourth or fifth step, he had to reach down and tug up his sword belt. He had lost the sword on the fist, but the scabbard still weighed down the belt. He did have two knives, the dragonglass dagger John had given him, and the steel one he cut his meat with. All that weight dragged heavy, and his belly was so big and round that if he forgot to tug, the belt slipped right off and tangled round his ankles, no matter how tight he cinched it. He had tried belting it above his belly once, but then it almost came to his armpits. Gren had laughed himself sick at the sight of it, and Dolorous Ed had said, "Cor, I knew a man once, eh, who wore his sword on a chain around his neck like that. One day he stumbled, eh, and the hilt went up his nose, eh?" Sam was stumbling himself. There were rocks beneath the snow, and the roots of trees, and sometimes deep holes in the frozen ground. Black Bernard had stepped in one and broken his ankle 3 days past, or maybe four, or he did not know how long it had been, truly. The Lord Commander had put Bernard on a horse after that. Sobbing, Sam took another step. It felt more like he was falling down than walking, falling endlessly, but never hitting the ground, just falling forward and forward.
"I have to stop. It hurts too much. I'm so cold and tired. I need to sleep. Just a little sleep beside a fire and a bite to eat that isn't frozen."
But if he stopped, he died. He knew that. They all knew that, the few who were left. They had been 50 when they fled the fist, maybe more, but some had wandered off in the snow, a few wounded had bled to death. And sometimes Sam heard shouts behind him from the rear guard, and once an awful scream. When he heard that, he had run 20 yards or 30, as fast and as far as he could, his half-frozen feet kicking up the snow. He would be running still if his legs were stronger.
"They are behind us. They are still behind us. They are taking us one by one."
Sobbing, Sam took another step. He had been cold so long he was forgetting what it was like to feel warm. He wore 3 pairs of hose, 2 layers of small clothes, beneath a double lambswool tunic, and over that a thick quilted coat that padded him against the cold steel of his chainmail. Over the hauberk he had a loose surcoat. Over that, a triple-thick cloak with a bone button that fastened tight under his chins. Its hood flopped forward over his forehead. Heavy fur mitts covered his hands over thin wool and leather gloves. A scarf was wrapped snugly about the lower half of his face, and he had a tight-fitting fleece-lined cap pulled down over his ears beneath the hood. And still the cold was in him. His feet, especially. He couldn't even feel them now, but only yesterday they had hurt so bad he could hardly bear to stand on them, let alone walk. Every step made him want to scream. Was that yesterday? He could not remember. He had not slept since the fist, not once since the horn had blown, unless it was while he was walking. Could a man walk while he was sleeping? Sam did not know, or else he had forgotten. Sobbing, he took another step. The snow swirled down around him. Sometimes it fell from a white sky, and sometimes from a black. But that was all that remained of day and night. He wore it on his shoulders like a second cloak, and it piled up high atop the pack he carried, and made it even heavier and harder to bear. The small of his back hurt abominably, as if someone had shoved a knife in there and was wiggling it back and forth with every step. His shoulders were in agony from the weight of the mail. He would have given almost anything to take it off, but he was afraid to. Anyway, he would have needed to remove his cloak and surcoat to get at it, and then the cold would have him.
"If only I was stronger."
He wasn't, though, and it was no good wishing. Sam was weak and fat. So very fat he could hardly bear his own weight. The mail was much too much for him. It felt as though it was rubbing his shoulders raw, despite the layers of cloth and quilt between the steel and skin. The only thing he could do was cry. And when he cried, the tears froze on his cheeks. Sobbing, he took another step. The crust was broken where he set his feet. Otherwise, he did not think he could have moved at all. Off to the left and right, half-seams with the silent trees, torches turned to vague orange halos in the falling snow. When he turned his head, he could see them, slipping silent through the wood, bobbing up and down and back and forth.
"The old bear's ring of fire," he reminded himself, "and woe to him who leaves it."
As he walked, it seemed as if he were chasing the torches ahead of him. But they had legs as well, longer and stronger than his, so he could never catch them. Yesterday he begged for them to let him be one of the torchbearers, even if it meant walking outside of the column with the darkness pressing close. He wanted the fire, dreamed of the fire.
"If I had the fire, I would not be cold."
But someone reminded him that he'd had a torch at the start, but he'd dropped it in the snow and snuffed the fire out. Sam didn't remember dropping any torch, but he supposed it was true. He was too weak to hold his arm up for long. Was it Ed who reminded him about the torch, or Gren? He couldn't remember that either.
"Fat and weak and useless. Even my wits are freezing now."
He took another step. He had wrapped his scarf over his nose and mouth, but it was covered with snot now, and so stiff he feared it must be frozen to his face. Even breathing was hard, and the air was so cold it hurt to swallow it.
"Mother, have mercy,"
he muttered in a hushed, husky voice beneath the frozen mask.
"Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy."
With each prayer he took another step, dragging his legs through the snow.
"Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy."
His own mother was 1,000 leagues south, safe with his sisters and his little brother Dickon in the keep at Horn Hill.
"She can't hear me, no more than the mother above."
The mother was merciful, all the Septons agreed, but the Seven had no power beyond the wall. This was where the old gods ruled, the nameless gods of the trees and the wolves and the snow.
"Mercy,"
he whispered then, to whatever might be listening, old gods or new, or demons too.
"Oh, mercy, mercy me, mercy me."
Massin screamed for mercy.
Why had he suddenly remembered that? It was nothing he wanted to remember. The man had stumbled backward, dropping his sword, pleading, yielding, even yanking off his thick black glove and thrusting it up before him, as if it were a gauntlet. He was still shrieking for quarter as the white lifted him in the air by the throat and near ripped the head off him.
"The dead have no mercy left in them. And the others, oh no, I mustn't think of that. Don't think, don't remember, just walk, just walk, just walk."
Sobbing, he took another step. A root beneath the crust caught his toe, and Sam tripped and fell heavily to one knee, so hard he bit his tongue. He could taste the blood in his mouth, warmer than anything he'd tasted since the fist.
"This is the end,"
he thought. Now that he had fallen, he could not seem to find the strength to rise again. He groped for a tree branch and clutched it tight, trying to pull himself back to his feet, but his stiff legs would not support him. The mail was too heavy, and he was too fat besides, and too weak, and too tired.
"Back on your feet, Piggy,"
someone growled as he went past, but Sam paid him no mind.
"I'll just lie down in the snow, I close my eyes."
It wouldn't be so bad, dying here. He couldn't possibly be any colder, and after a little while he wouldn't be able to feel the ache in his lower back or the terrible pain in his shoulders, no more than he could his feet.
"I won't be the first to die. They can't say I was."
Hundreds had died on the fist. They had died all around him, and more had died after. He'd seen them. Shivering, Sam released his grip on the tree and eased himself down into the snow. It was cold and wet, he knew, but he could scarcely feel it through all his clothing. He stared upward at the pale white sky as snowflakes drifted down upon his stomach and his chest and his eyelids.
"The snow will cover me like a thick white blanket. It will be warm under the snow. And if they speak of me, they will have to say I died a man of the night's watch. I did. I did. I did my duty. No one could say I forswore myself. I'm fat, and I'm weak, and I'm craven. But I did my duty."
The ravens had been his responsibility. That was why they had brought him along. He hadn't wanted to go. He'd told them so. He'd told them all what a big coward he was. But Maester Aemon was very old and blind besides, so they had had to send Sam to tend the ravens. The Lord Commander had given him his orders when they made their camp on the fist.
"You're no fighter. We both know that, boy. If it happens that we're attacked, don't go trying to prove otherwise. You'll just get in the way. You ought to send a message. And don't come running to ask what the letter should say. Write it out yourself, and send one bird to Castle Black and another to the Shadow Tower."
The old bear pointed a gloved finger right in Sam's face.
"I don't care if you're so scared you foul your breeches.
and I don't care if 1,000 wildlings are coming over the walls howling for your blood. You get those birds off, or I swear I'll hunt you through all 7 hells and make you damn sorry that you didn't."
And Mormont's own raven had bobbed its head up and down and croaked,
"Sorry, sorry, sorry."
Sam was sorry. Sorry he hadn't been braver, or stronger, or good with swords, that he hadn't been a better son to his father, and a better brother to Dickon and the girls. He was sorry to die, too, but better men had died on the Fist, good men and true, not squeaking fat boys like him. At least he would not have the old bear hunting him through hell, though.
"I got the birds off. I did that right, at least."
He had written out the messages ahead of time, short messages and simple, telling of an attack on the Fist of the First Men, and then he had tucked them away safe in his parchment pouch, hoping he would never need to send them. When the horns blew, Sam had been sleeping. He thought he was dreaming them at first, but when he opened his eyes, snow was falling on the camp, and the Black Brothers were all grabbing bows and spears and running towards the ring wall. Chet was the only one nearby. Maester Aemon's old steward, with his face full of boils and the big wen on his neck. Sam had never seen so much fear on a man's face as he saw on Chet's when that third blast came moaning through the trees.
"Help me get the birds off,"
he pleaded, but the other steward had turned and run off, dagger in hand.
"He has the dogs to care for," Sam remembered.
Probably the Lord Commander had given him some orders as well. His fingers had been so stiff and clumsy in the gloves, and he was shaking from fear and cold, but he found the parchment pouch and dug out the messages he'd written. The ravens were shrieking furiously, and when he opened the castle black cage, one of them flew right in his face. Two more escaped before Sam could catch one, and when he did, it pecked him through his glove, drawing blood. Yet somehow he held on long enough to attach the little roll of parchment. The war horn had fallen silent by then, but the Fist rang with shouted commands and the clatter of steel.
"Fly!"
Sam called as he tossed the raven into the air. The birds in the Shadow Tower cage were screaming and fluttering about so madly that he was afraid to open the door, but he made himself do it anyway. This time he caught the first raven that tried to escape. A moment later it was clawing its way up through the falling snow, bearing word of the attack. His duty done, he finished dressing with clumsy, frightened fingers, donning his cap and surcoat and hooded cloak, and buckling on his sword belt, buckling it real tight so it wouldn't fall down. Then he found his pack and stuffed all his things inside, spare small clothes and dry socks, the dragon glass arrowheads and spearhead John had given him, and the old horn, too, his parchments, inks and quills, the maps he'd been drawing, and a rock-hard garlic sausage he'd been saving since the war. He tied it all up and shouldered the pack onto his back.
"The Lord Commander said I wasn't to rush to the ring wall," he recalled, "but he said I shouldn't come running to him either."
Sam took a deep breath and realized that he did not know what to do next. He remembered turning in a circle, lost, the fear growing inside him as it always did. There were dogs barking and horses trumpeting, but the snow muffled the sounds and made them seem far away. Sam could see nothing beyond 3 yards, not even the torches burning along the low stone wall that ringed the crown of the hill.
Could the torches have gone out?
That was too scary to think about.
The horn blew thrice long. 3 long blasts means others.
The white walkers of the wood, the cold shadows, the monsters of the tales that made him squeak and tremble as a boy, riding their giant ice spiders, hungry for blood. Awkwardly, he drew his sword and plodded heavily through the snow, holding it. A dog ran past, barking, and he saw some of the men from the Shadow Tower, big bearded men with long axes and 8-foot spears. He felt safer for their company, so he followed them to the wall. When he saw the torches still burning atop the ring of stones, a shudder of relief went through him. The Black Brothers stood with swords and spears in hand, watching the snowfall, waiting. Sir Mallador Locke went by on his horse, wearing a snow-speckled helm. Sam stood well back behind the others, looking for Gren or Dolorous Ed.
"If I have to die, let me die beside my friends," he remembered thinking.
But all the men around him were strangers, Shadow Tower men, under the command of the ranger named Blaine.
"Here they come," he heard a brother say. "Notch," said Blaine,
and 20 black arrows were pulled from as many quivers, and notched to as many bowstrings.
"Gods be good, there's hundreds,"
a voice said softly.
"Draw,"
Blaine said, and then,
"Hold."
Sam could not see and did not want to see. The men of the Night's Watch stood behind their torches, waiting, with arrows pulled back to their ears, as something came up that dark, slippery slope through the snow.
"Hold,"
Blaine said again.
"Hold! Hold!"
And then,
"Loose!"
The arrows whispered as they flew. A ragged cheer went up from the men along the ring wall, but it died quickly.
"They're not stopping, my lord,"
a man said to Blaine, and another shouted,
"More, look there, coming from the trees,"
and yet another said,
"Gods of mercy, they's crawling, they's almost here, they're on us!"
Sam had been backing away by then, shaking like the last leaf on the tree when the wind kicks up, as much as from cold as from fear. It had been very cold that night.
"Even colder than now. The snow seems almost warm. I feel better now. A little rest was all I needed. Maybe in a little while I'll be strong enough to walk again. In a little while."
A horse stepped past his head, a shaggy grey beast with snow in its mane and hooves crusted with ice. Sam watched it come and watched it go. Another appeared from out of the falling snow, with a man in black leading it. When he saw Sam in his path, he cursed him and led the horse around.
"I wish I had a horse," he thought. "If I had a horse, I could keep going. I could sit, and even sleep some in a saddle."
Most of their mounts had been lost at the fist, though, and those that remained carried their food, their torches, and their wounded. Sam wasn't wounded.
"Only fat and weak, and the greatest craven in the Seven Kingdoms."
He was such a coward. Lord Randall, his father, had always said so, and he had been right. Sam was his heir, but he had never been worthy, so his father had sent him away to the wall. His little brother Dickon would inherit the Tarley lands and castle, and the great sword, Heartsbane, that the lords of Hornhill had borne so proudly for centuries. He wondered whether Dickon would shed a tear for his brother, who died in the snow, somewhere off beyond the edge of the world.
"Why should he? A coward's not worth weeping over."
He had heard his father tell his mother as much 50 times. The old bear knew it too.
"Fire arrows!"
the Lord Commander roared that night on the fist, when he appeared suddenly astride his horse.
"Give them flame!"
It was then he noticed Sam there, quaking.
"Tarley, get out of here. Your place is with the ravens."
I got the messages away."
"Good."
On Mormont's shoulder, his own raven echoed,
"Good, good."
The Lord Commander looked huge in fur and mail. Behind his black iron visor, his eyes were fierce.
"You're in the way here. Go back to your cages. If I need to send another message, I don't want to have to find you first. See that the birds are ready."
He did not wait for a response, but turned his horse and trotted around the ring, shouting,
"Fire! Give them fire!"
Sam did not need to be told twice. He went back to the birds as fast as his fat legs could carry him.
"I should write the message ahead of time," he thought, "so we can get the birds away as fast as needs be."
It took him longer than it should have to light his little fire to warm the frozen ink. He sat beside it on a rock with quill and parchment and wrote his messages.
"Attacked amid snow and cold, but we thrown them back with fire arrows," he wrote, as he heard Thorin Smallwood's voice ring out with a command of, "Notch! Draw!"